The Volume.
Jenkins and Jones is presented by FanDuel Sportsbook. There's no better place to bet the action than on FanDuel Sportsbook during the football season. Tons of reasons why I love betting the NFL on FanDuel Sportsbook. It's America's number one sportsbook. It's easy to use, it's fast, safe, and secure, and it has fast payouts as quick as 2 hours. There's also so many bet types, including same-game parlay bets, live betting, player props, and futures. FanDuel is making it easy for everyone to bet this season with a bunch of promotions that they'll be sharing all season long on our podcast. If you've been listening along, you've heard a lot of those. There's risk-free bets and same-game parlay bets, enhanced odds markets, and more. If you're new, just download the FanDuel Sportsbook app to get started now and sign up with promo code J&J so they know we sent you. That's J&J. Disclaimer, must be 21 and over and present in Arizona, Colorado, Connecticut, Indiana, Michigan, New Jersey, Tennessee, Virginia, or West Virginia. Gambling problem, call 1-800-GAMBLER. See full terms and conditions at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Welcome to Jenkins and Jones on the Volume Podcast Network. It's, what is it? Monday, December 13th.
Is it? Is it Monday?
Is it? I'll tell you a little secret here in the podcasting business. We're actually recording this late Sunday night.
Pulling back the veil here.
Behind the scenes of the podcast world.
You know what I'm saying?
As always, Jenkins and Jones is hosted by my good friends, Dragonfly Jones, a.k.a. Tyler.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
Legethro Jenkins, a.k.a. John.
What's up, Bubbas?
I'm Guardy B, a.k.a. Mike, and we've got a great episode. We've got Mike Sielski, the host and producer of the new I Am Kobe podcast series, as well as the author of a new book called The Rise, Kobe Bryant and the Pursuit of Immortality, that'll be out in January. Definitely stick around. Really enjoy that interview with Mike. But first, before we get to anything else, John wants to continue...
I just want to button it up, y'all.
Like you're double fucking entendre. 1998.
That's y'all, Jabobi wearing ass niggas right now, G. You feel me? No, I want to say y'all saw a cool nigga in a cool shirt, huh? PJ Tucker.
No, it was a short set. Let's not reduce this. He wore the short set.
What if I told you 2 Chainz wore the shirt too?
Okay, I need to see that.
Now it's a cool shirt.
You know, did he wear the short set?
I need to see that.
The short set, bro. Like I told you, the short set is where I saw the light.
A Met ball attending ass dude who treats the fucking tunnel like it's the red carpet. You know what I'm saying? Wore that shirt. It's a cool shirt, bro.
You flat motherfucker, out. You said you wanted this on the topic list to close the conversation the 950 flame shirt.
Come on, now we ain't got to talk about that, dog. Ain't nobody talk about the price,
$950 American. Not yen, cool not shirt. Pesos.
Nah, y'all had Tim the Tool Man Taylor looking motherfuckers in my damn mention talking shit, talking about I'm a simp. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Wolverine boot built body niggas talking shit, okay? You know what I'm saying? Nah, G. You know, get these Bob the Builder niggas up out of here, dog. That's a cool shirt on a cool dude all of a sudden.
No,
you know
it's
what
a
mean?
Short. The short. You, like I said, you keep skipping over the short set part. I told you. No, I told you.
$150 hat, Tyler.
I told you.
Kill the hype, $150
I told you,
hat.
I told you I like the short set on PJ Tucker because the short set is a whole different thing from the
short pants.
Because
he make it looking like a $950 shirt made by a literal artist look like a flea market shirt. Yes. Ain't nothing flea market about that shirt, dog.
It's a short
That's
set.
Not flea market.
Short sets are flea market in their entire fucking core. Bro, what do you mean there's nothing flea market about a short set?
We talking about PJ Tucker wearing
it's
it, bro.
It's a short set.
He ain't, but that's not, bro, it's not flea market. You stop, you playing yourself with that,
PJ
dog.
From the hood. PJ from Southside Raleigh, dog.
PJ also wore bell bottoms at the Met Ball, bro.
Okay, he's a diverse man. He ain't no bell bottom ass nigga. He's a Southside Raleigh nigga. And that was
he's Southside Raleigh, but he's also grown into a motherfucking.
I told you, I like the short set. because the short set leans so much into the tackiness of it that it becomes fresh. Now, when you try to throw the fucking pants on it, that's where it falls flat for you, bro. That's
bro,
where you lose.
You ain't see it with the pants. You just saw it. You ain't even see what what's the name had on. You just saw the shirt and said it was
no.
A,
he had some black pants
fire.
On.
He had some black cargo on. Pants, like he was about to pull a fucking Yu-Gi-Oh deck out of his pocket.
I didn't see what he. I didn't see the pants he had on. But the point is, bro. You talk like this is where he got the shirt at. He had to book a time, bro, like an art gallery. He is literally going to an art gallery set up.
Just because
you know
it's
saying?
Exclusive, it doesn't mean it's not drawn
I'm not saying
from flea
exclusive.
Market
I'm
couture
saying,
type
I'm,
shit.
I'm not saying it's exclusive, bro. I'm saying the way the you, it's not a flea market ass shirt, bro. That's
it's inspired
flea
by flea
that.
Market shit. It's a short
that,
set.
No,
you cannot
was
tell me
by nerd.
You can't
said he was a fashion gentrifier. You said I was a fashion gentrifier.
Yes.
Well, who is it? What,
yes.
It
throwing. If you take a short set and then you throw pants on and say that this doesn't make it a short set anymore, that's gentrifying, dog.
Dude, we saw.
Like, come
we
on,
saw,
man.
No, I didn't say that. We saw white boys in 2016 wearing short sets, dog, with Sperry topsiders, and that, yeah. And that's flea market too. That ain't flea market, bro.
You
know
talk about some chaps fucking short set. That short, no, that shit looks like it came out the same plastic bag with the shirt and the shorts. You know what I'm talking about, bro. Don't do this. Don't do this.
Bro, that's not, that ain't come from Glicks, my boy. That ain't come from Glicks.
That particular short set did not, but it is inspired by short sets that
you're
did,
talking
bro.
Like he's, you talking like he's shopping at Rainbow. Stop playing, dog. This is a dude that wears full length Gucci coats.
Let me peel the curtain back a little further. We're texting in the group chat about topics for the pod. John suggests we talk about this shirt again. I said in all caps, no.
talked about peanut butter and jelly for 3 weeks, bro. We've been
John
arguing
said,
about squirrels
and
rats
and
for three
quote,
years. We could continue with this shirt. We can continue with this.
It's squashed, my friend. We gotta just officially say it's done.
In the group chat, we came to a conclusion. You know what I mean? But now, you know what I'm saying? Now I'm still a gentrifier. I must defend myself. Y'all got my Twitter shut down. You know what I'm saying? By a nigga built like a bag of beans. You know what I'm saying? You feel me? Y'all had that mini fridge looking nigga come in my shit and call me a simp. Shit, fuck out of here. A nigga that ain't never put a fit on in his entire life. When I asked him to see how he coming, he didn't come, didn't he? He didn't come. He stayed home. He was a family man like he was supposed to, nigga. So say the fuck about my mentions, motherfucker. You feel me? Come on now. Y'all had him coming. We got to button it up. You feel me? Come on now.
Is it buttoned up? Are we good?
It's buttoned up. Let's all move right, on. We sure. Just disagree. But I ain't no fashion. I ain't no geek. I ain't no gentrifier in any way, shape, or form. Keep it a stack. Let's go.
That conversation was over to me when you told us that shit cost $950, bro.
No, it was because we kept talking, Mike. We kept talking.
It's over in my heart.
Okay, okay. But you said you agreed with me intellectually in how you approached the shit. You feel me?
Yeah, no, actually, I do want to bring this up because I threw this out on Twitter. This is not about the shirt, but I believe every person has a form of art that they recognize takes talent. They're not discrediting the people who do it. You recognize it takes talent. You recognize you couldn't do it. You recognize it's art. You just can't, in your heart, give one half of a single fuck about it. And that is fashion for me. I mentioned on Twitter, a bunch of people hit me up and said it's dance for them, mm-hmm. or it's, you know, certain types of music, whatever else. It's just, so for me, as soon as I see a shirt cost $950, my brain
turned
off.
You didn't see that it cost that, you feel me, until I showed you. And I looked it up, and it was funny that it actually came from a dude who's an artist from Gallery Department, which is one of the coldest brands right now.
And I'm happy for him getting people to give him $950 for the shirt.
It won't be your boy, you feel me? I'm just saying.
Could it be me?
The fact that I wanted to wear it to the LACMA, you know what I'm saying? I saw a LACMA quality shirt on Nick Anderson, you know what I'm saying? Or Slow Mo, you feel me? You know what I mean? Like y'all didn't see that. I'm just saying. I was a gentrifier.
Yes,
I was
yes,
Guy Fieri
because
out
you
here,
wanted to take
you know
a
I mean?
You wanted to take a short set and throw some pants on and go to the art gallery. That is gentrifying, bro.
I'm just saying. I gave an example of where I would be. I also said I'd be on the hardwood. If I my foot on the hardwood, I wear it. It's a shirt that I would wear ever so often. It's not a shirt I would wear consistently. I was just saying in those moments. It didn't have to be wore at the LACMA. I'm just saying that's the places I go, bro. I don't go other places. I'm not in the club. I'm not into doing none of that shit.
The person
I mean?
Who really
and I said
you
I wear
up.
It with a with a socks hat. The person I said I really wear with a socks hat and some Common Projects, which
was
sneakers.
Not me, and it was not Tyler who fucked you up. It was Jackson who fucked you up with the edit on that clip.
Oh no, he said no. I appreciate the content. I appreciate the content.
But the cut was so good, it brought the Wolverine shoe into your mentions. Right.
It brought a lot of people that might have voted Trump in 2016. Maybe not 2020, but in 2016. And we gotta correct this on the pod in front of them as well. You know what I mean? They might not be red, but they purple. And we gotta talk to the purple folk. You know, if you feel what I'm saying? Let's go. I appreciate you, Jackson. But no, it was good content. I told you I loved it. And I knew I was gonna come here and get flamed. But when somebody try to say I'm simping, first of all, you don't even mean simping. You don't know what it means. You know what I'm saying, Tim Allen? You know what I'm saying? You don't know what the fuck it means, my G. You feel me? But when I had, hey, bro, we got to talk about it then. You feel me?
I can't believe you lured us into a, hey, let's just button it up, and you still want to work. This was some Ric Flair when he goes, no, then pokes a motherfucker in his eye. That's what John hit us with just now. What the fuck, man?
No, Mike like, no. I'm like, nigga, we talked about peanut butter and jelly for that long, and I can't even get my issue off right here.
you Groucho Marxed us on this, man. Shit. Come on, G. All right. Speaking of purple people, let's talk about Urban Meyer's fucking burst blood vessel. Ass fucking Urban Meyer, it's all falling apart.
Varicose vein ass, you feel me?
Varicose vein face. Urban Meyer is going poorly in Jacksonville. They got shut out today by the Titans, but earlier this week the report came out that, quote, during a staff meeting, Meyer delivered a biting message that he's a winner and his assistant coaches are losers, according to several people informed of the contents of the meeting, challenging each coach individually to explain when they've ever won and forcing them to defend their resumes. Question: did someone else hire the assistant coaching staff for the Jaguars?
He would not have tried me like that. On God, he would not have tried me.
I would have been like,
you know my background. You did a background check on me when you hired me, right, motherfucker? What the fuck is this?
Right. You asking me why you hired me? Right. You know what I'm saying? That's a question you should ask yourself, my boy.
The only bad thing on my resume is you.
Right.
You are fucking up my resume.
I made a bad decision, not you. You the loser. This motherfucker said, I'm a winner and y'all are losers. What the hell? You picked me. Because I'm a winner. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? You are the smudge on my CV. You know what I'm saying? Matter of fact, I quit. I'm going where the winner's at. You feel me? I'm not having this man talk. He ain't never won at this level. You know what I mean? He faking heart attacks in heavy situations, bro. The definition of a loser. You know what I mean? Shoot. Get the fuck out of here. That's crazy. Crazy. Urban Meyer being Urban Meyer. Golly.
Urban.
How can you walk around being you?
There's a clip of him shaking hands with Mike Vrabel after losing to the Titans today where I think he shook hands with him for 0.2 seconds. He didn't make any eye contact. It was just like, moving on. And then he gets in the press conference, talks shit on whoever it was that leaked this story about this horrible meeting. And then when a reporter said, your offensive line played terrible, they get paid a lot of money to be that bad. And he looked at the reporter and he said, yep. Like...
That motherfucker ready to go, dog. I don't know why they're dragging this out. Get him the fuck out of there, man.
What are the rules of the contract? He just can't quit? Like, because, I mean, he's going to get some money somewhere else. They're going to throw him a bag in college somewhere. You know what I mean?
He's in a spite off with Shad Khan, the owner of the Jaguars, where Urban wants out and the Jaguars owner knows he wants out, but he's not gonna buy him out. So they're just like... they just have a gun to each other's head and all six chambers are filled. It's like Russian roulette, but the opposite direction. You know what I mean?
Jesus Christ. That is frightening. The image scared me, but go ahead.
Okay. Speaking of difficult situations, let's talk about... Former First Lady of the United States of America, Nancy Reagan.
Break it all the way down, because like y'all know I can't get on Twitter right now.
Yeah.
So break it all the way down. I did see it on Google. That's okay. How big it was, where I was seeing it. Like,
you were just scrolling Google. That's the right, saddest right. shit.
Don't. I mean, dog,
I was on there like three times. I was on there like three. I was actually looking to try to find where that shirt was at, and I saw it. Don't keep it in the stack. You know what I mean? But I had a great weekend. You know what I'm saying?
All right. One of the traditional living type of Twitter accounts, you know, the conservative value, traditional living.
Classy verse, I saw that, you know what I mean?
Posted a tweet that was like, here's a picture of Madonna with her boob out at 63. Here's a picture of Nancy Reagan at 63, dressed like a gondolier in the Naples canals with her family. And for some reason, someone replied to this with a clip from her, the biography of Nancy Reagan.
And Nancy had them jaws.
She had that
gator neck.
You
feel me? You know what I mean? You feel me? Queen Bopperooski. Yeah, that's what they say. Yeah. That's what they called her back in the day.
That in the back of the throat.
Yo,
right
throw there. Shouty. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Gobble, gobble. You feel me? With the side throw neck. You know what I'm saying?
With the yobble, yobble. And
she hit it with that, oh, wee, yay. She hit it with that, help me, Lord. You know what I'm saying? Claude have mercy. Nancy Reagan. This is the coolest thing I ever found out about a Reagan. You know what I'm saying? What they say, she was in double B, WB on the yaka, 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 yaka. You know what I'm saying? Jawmaster 5000. Woo, boy, they said that dome was that is fire, bro. Good for you, Nancy. That don't keep you young, don't it?
I believe it was the MGM lot, not the WB
MGM lot. There we go. MGM lot, you know what I'm saying? Knee pads on deck at all times. Pardon me.
Tyler said it. This is why you don't. You have to leave your high horse off the timeline, bro. Because all Twitter is a collection of a billion people who want to knock you off your high horse. Nancy didn't even do anything. She's dead.
Happily, probably too.
This you know traditional living's Twitter account put her on a high horse and fucking got her shit knocked out.
No. For her to get sniped.
No. No. And the dude who posted the excerpt from the book, motherfucker had like 50 followers, bro. Like, he might have technically pulled off the biggest ratio ever. You know, if you base it on the ripple effect of one tweet. Like, yeah, he turned Twitter upside fucking down with everybody talking about Nancy Reagan, you know, doing a goddamn, you know, yabble, yabble, yabble. You feel me?
What I love is he basically said, nah, Nancy Reagan wasn't classy. You just boring. Yeah. You know what I mean? You know what I mean? Like, dog, you know, she had her fun too. You just don't. You know what I mean?
Funniest shit was when I explained this to Summer. Right, because Summer ain't on Twitter, right? You know, she's on Instagram and TikTok.
God bless. God bless her, yes.
Yeah. She's not a TikToker. I want to make that distinction clear. TikTokers are a whole different species of human. But she's on TikTok. You know what I'm saying?
TikTok's algorithm is better than any algorithm when it comes to content. I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
And once you get on algorithm, that algorithm will find everything that you actually like. It's fire.
Yeah, yeah. So
well, go ahead.
So you know, I was talking to her. I was like, hey, you heard how they're talking about how Nancy Reagan was a throat goat? And she was like, throat goat? What is a throat goat?
God tier wobble wobble, you know what I'm saying?
Right? And then I explained it to her. We were laughing about that shit, you know, what a throat goat is exactly. She was like, I'm about to call my homegirl and call her a throat goat. And I was like, put her on speaker. It's like 11 in the morning. We in the bed. And she calls her homegirl like, hey, what up, throat goat? And her girl's like,
what?
Homegirl's like, what? What is that? Twitter's a different world, bro. Twitter's a whole
it
different
is.
World.
Because everyone
on Twitter, yeah, everyone on Twitter knows what a throat goat is, and no one in the real world did. You know,
so. I feel like that describes a lot of the things that we all enjoy about Twitter. Is like,
also how horrible Twitter is, bro. That's like I told you, my weekend was great without Twitter. You know what I mean? But it's fun, but it's also, yeah, like, I don't think we need to know what a throat goat is. I don't think Summer's life is better because she knew Nancy Reagan and had the knee pads in the purse at all times.
I do want to emphasize, because I saw a couple people talking about, like, you know, this is typical high school shit. People don't like a woman, so they're, you know, they're calling her a slut or whatever. I think it's tremendous that the point of this, to me, is Madonna's having fun, Nancy Reagan's having fun,
and the person
who posted this tweet isn't not having fun.
You know what I mean?
That's the thing that I took away from it. It's not like, oh, Nancy Reagan is a bad person or some shit like that. It's like, everyone has a public image, especially back in the 80s and 90s when we weren't inside of the middle of every celebrity's head 24 hours a day. Yeah. You had a public persona, and you had who you really were in real life. And who you really were in real life, I'm sure, especially in the fucking Republican Party, was always way more fun than who you were when you fucking put your gondolier outfit on to take your family photo at the White House.
Nancy Reagan ducked off in the bathroom with Moses right now looking down like, that's a lie. You know what I mean? Sending him to the heaven above heaven, you feel me? And good for Nancy, dog. You know, I'm trying. She might be able to teach me something on the other side, and maybe I was reaching right there.
You're reaching for one of you. probably for her.
Right.
All right. Let's talk about before we get to our interview with Mike Sielski. I know one thing people have really loved about the show over the years is John putting them on to new music, but Tyler, I think, put both of us on to Chris Crack.
For sure.
And we're working on getting him on the show for an interview. But Tyler, you wanna recommend Chris Crack to the people?
Hell yeah. Go to his Apple Music page. He got like 20 fucking albums. I'm not even exaggerating. In like the last 2 years, and they're all fucking amazing. I know everyone says, you know, every artist is amazing that they like, but no, he's so good. His fucking quality versus quantity ratio is fucking phenomenal. He's a fun motherfucker. He's hilarious, and he's talented too. Big fucking Chris Crack fan, bro. And I can't wait to have him on here and chop it up with him.
I can't wait to ask him questions like he say, you know, talking about like messing with women with the missing the side tooth. I'm like, you too young to know about that. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? How you know about that, young buck? You feel what I'm saying? Like, dog, he's hilarious. You know what I'm saying? What'd he say? They harmless. They just crackheads. They harmless, I promise. You know what I mean? The ad-libs are perfect, bro. Like, for real, they have the laugh track under some of his, like, the skits and stuff. It's brilliant. It's brilliantly produced. You know what I mean? And also, he is rapping. There's not a single person like him in the game. You very seldomly see somebody make as much music like this, as good as it is, and consistently funny. It's one of the best listening experiences. It's my favorite listening experience right now. I've been listening to him for like the last 3 days. You know what I mean? Where I'm laughing one moment and I'm vibing the next. And then he got crazy one-liners. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. That you just find yourself yelling while riding in the car. You know what I'm saying? Or just walking down the street, not even listening to music. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. You know where I had her at. You know what I'm saying? I'm just, you know, I didn't even know. I forgot the Travelodge existed. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He's fire, though, bro.
For real. You know, going to what you said, like, he raps his ass off. He's super fucking creative, super talented, thinks outside the box. His production is crazy. And usually, you know, rappers who are that serious about their craft usually take themselves very seriously. And it's a very serious listening experience. And it's the complete opposite with fucking Chris Crack, right? The music is fire, but you're having fun and you're laughing listening to this shit. So, yeah,
you're having a
Chris Crack fan.
It feel like when the fun you have when you listen to them young rappers, you know what I'm saying, with a rapper that got real bars. It's that level of fun with like a mumble rapper. Is mumble rapper fun with listening to somebody that got straight bars, bro, that can just rap? I can't stop listening to him. I put my little brother on him, and he hit me with the full caps response. You know what I'm saying? Like, yo, you know what I mean? Yeah, yo, it's crazy, bro. You know what I mean? I'm really excited to just rap with the dude. You know what I mean? Just an interesting cat.
All right, stick around for our interview with Mike Sielski. The NFL playoffs are almost here, and to help you stay on top of the action, FanDuel Sportsbook is giving you a $10 bonus when you place $20 in same-game parlay bets. Bet on a single game or spread your bets out across multiple matchups. It's up to you. As long as you bet $20 in the same-game parlays during the same week of NFL action, you're getting a $10 bonus. Big Monday Night Football game between the Cardinals and the Rams. I think I'm a big believer in Kyler Murray and the Cardinals, so I would take
the Cardinals spread and money line. I would take the over for their points. I would take the over for yards for Kyler Murray. And that is how I would get my bonus on the same game parlay bet. But that's not the only thing to love about betting with FanDuel Sportsbook. They also have fast payouts. It's easy to use, safe and secure, and it's America's number one sportsbook. This same game parlay bonus is live through week 15. So lock in some winners today and enjoy a $10 bonus on FanDuel. New to FanDuel Sportsbook? Sign up today with promo code JNJ to also receive a risk-free bet up to $1,000. That's promo code JNJ. That's J ampersand J, so they know we sent you. Exclusively on the FanDuel Sportsbook app. Disclaimer, must be 21 and over and present in Arizona, Colorado, Connecticut, Indiana, Michigan, New Jersey, Tennessee, Virginia, or West Virginia. Bonus issued is non-withdrawable site credit that expires in 7 days. Max bonus $10. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP. We're very excited to welcome on our special guest for the show, Mike Sielski. Mike is a writer at the Philadelphia Inquirer, but right now he is Mr. Kobe Bryant. He is the host and producer of the I Am Kobe podcast that's coming out from iHeartRadio right now. The first 5 episodes are available. You can search I Am Kobe. And he also has a book called The Rise, Kobe Bryant and the Pursuit of Immortality, coming out in January. Mike, this is a real treat, man. We're really excited you're jumping on with us. Thank you.
No, thank you for having me. It's exciting for me, too.
So you and I were talking a little bit before we started rolling, and I just want to start here. I grew up in Southern California. Kobe Bryant, incredibly complicated, beloved athlete here. But since, you know, the tragic shock, obviously, of him dying, I've never seen anything in my lifetime happen with an athlete like this. That he's sort of been like lionized almost, right? There's murals kind of all over Southern California, and there's just this huge sort of swell of emotion. You are sort of almost cutting against that, it feels like, and really trying to paint a realistic portrait of a human being, which sometimes that gets lost, right, in the rush to lionize someone. So what has this process been like for you, given everything that's happened over the last couple of years?
So the advantage of the two projects, that the book and the podcast, have been that they've allowed me to deal with a side of Kobe that, and an aspect of his life that a lot of people in my area, in the Philadelphia and the suburbs around the city, in our area, know pretty well, but that LA and the rest of the country and even the rest of the world doesn't know as well. So my goal with the book and the pod was to kind of do Batman Begins for the Black Mamba. I wanted to show everybody, like, everything you think everything we know about Kobe from the time he joined the Lakers until the day he died, you can kind of see the beginnings of those things, those qualities, in the first 18 years of his life. And so, yeah, there is a bit of like cutting against the, like, you know, you put it like the mythology of him, right? That everybody loves him right now. And kind of conveniently forgets, you know, the battles with Shaq and the really controversial, you know, darker stuff that he was responsible for and that he underwent and all those sorts of things. And I'm not saying I went out to, like, you know, rip Kobe or paint him to be something he wasn't. I'm just saying, I think, Mike, you make a good point. Like, I'm trying to tell a true story, and a true story is always gray. It's never just black. It's never just white.
The loss of Kobe still doesn't feel real. And we've discussed this on here, but it still feels weird talking about him as if he's not here anymore. And I have moments where I completely forget he's gone. Emotionally, how was your experience writing this? I just wonder how that felt.
Yeah, it was an interesting process because a lot of people who were really tight with him didn't speak to me. It was almost as if, because his death was so fresh, that they couldn't bring themselves to do it. They would have been too emotional in talking about it on the record for a book or an article or anything like that. There were other people who had talked about Kobe a lot and were happy to do it again. And there were other people who rarely had talked about Kobe and who were part of his life when he was young and really wanted to talk about him because they felt like their place in his life or the part of his life that they were involved with kind of got short shrifted in his story. Like, I'll give you an example, right? He was in at Lower Merion High School in suburban Philly. He was a member of the Black Student Union, the student voice at Lower Merion High School. Nobody ever mentions this about him. And he had a core group of friends and people who he was close to who knew him through that. And nobody had ever talked to them before. And nobody ever got that side of him when he was in high school. Like, what was it like for him to try to kind of figure out his identity as a black kid in a really kind of, you know, ritzy suburban area just outside Philly? Like, that's a really interesting part of his life story that not too many people explored. So there were a lot of different ways that that emotion kind of bubbled up. You know, I talked to one family member of his cousin, John Cox, who was like a little brother to him. But yeah, the people I did talk to, they missed him a lot. You could feel it in their voices. Some of them still talk about him in the present tense, to your point.
For sure, for sure. So you mentioned that, you know, you didn't want to necessarily do, you know, a Kobe propaganda piece. You wanted to, you know, include the Kobe story, warts and all that. But Kobe is a unique figure in that a lot of, like, you know, the warts, the ugly stuff, you know, with Kobe is kind of added to his legend. You know what I mean? Like when he drove Shaq out of town, like Kobe stands lean on that, like, yeah, he got Shaq out of there and still got two rings. You know what I mean? Like that's part of building Kobe up as well. So how did you toe that line where, when, you know, you had to tell about, you know, some of, you know, Kobe's shortcomings or times where he butted head with authority or what have you, and still, you know, paint it, you know, unbiasedly where you're not, you know, contributing to the mythology more?
Yeah, you just try to tell it as in as detailed and as straight a manner as you can. And that comes down to, like, your reporting and your research, right? Like, those anecdotes are out there and they're all part of what makes Kobe Kobe, or what made Kobe Kobe. There we are. We're talking about him in the present tense, just like we said. And you tell all of it, or at least as much of it as you can, because you know that all of that went into him being the man and the athlete and the figure that he was. You can talk to the English teacher who he was close to, who was his mentor, who saw, you know, the storytelling gift within him and really bonded with him. You talk to some of the teammates who say, like, hey, he wasn't the greatest guy all the time. You find out an anecdote where there's a rebounding drill at practice one day, and he's never lost a drill in practice ever. And this guy, his teammate, the second best player on the team, is about to get a rebound, and Kobe shoves him into the wall and cuts the guy's arm. He gets stitches on his arm, but Kobe wins the drill and raises the ball over his head triumphantly, like, I won the drill, as usual. You know, all of that goes into making Kobe Kobe. So if you leave any of it out, or you try to suppress any of it or play any of it up too much, you're not going to have a true story. You're just not going to capture everything that went into making him him. There was good stuff. There was not so great stuff. And you got to just kind of weave the whole tapestry.
So for those who have not listened to or heard about the podcast yet, it's really a fascinating slice that you've got here, where there's these audio tapes from when he was in high school, correct?
Yes.
You know, So go ahead. I mean, just talk about that and about, you know, how you sort of came across this story. And I just can't imagine. It must be super surreal cutting it together, listening to this 16, 17-year-old kid who we know what, you know, he becomes, but he doesn't really know at the time, obviously.
Right. All right. So in 1996, when Kobe, 95, 96, Kobe's a senior at Lower Marion. He's got an assistant coach on the team and a guy who had covered him a little bit named Jeremy Treatman. And he and Jeremy gets the idea of, like, trying to collaborate on a book with Kobe. So he starts doing these interviews with him while Kobe's
a senior in high school.
The summer of the draft, when he ends up with the Lakers, and then into his first season with the Lakers. They're doing these interviews all the time. And the book doesn't come off. The project falls through. But Jeremy's got these tapes, and he's got some of them transcribed. So I've known Jeremy a long time. He's since become a mover and shaker in Philly hoops. He's a hoops promoter. You know, runs a sports broadcasting camp for high school kids, all this stuff. So I've known him a long time. When I started doing the book, I reached out to him and he gave me the transcripts that he had done, right? So I have all these pages with that have Kobe's words on them, but he can't find the tapes. 3 days before Christmas, he's cleaning out his garage and he calls me up and he says, Mike, I found the tapes. The next day I drive over there. He's got these two Ziploc bags full of micro cassettes of him talking to Kobe. He hasn't listened to them in 25 years. Nobody's heard them. So he gives them to me. Insane. I've got like 2 months to listen to them, weave them into the book, and then we turned it into this podcast where it's Kobe talking about going to the senior prom with Brandy. It's Kobe cursing out Del Harris, his first coach with the Lakers, who he just did not like and thought was holding him back. It's Kobe talking about you know, maybe he'll go to Duke, maybe he'll go to LaSalle, maybe I'll go to college. I don't really know. Like, it's Kobe about why he loves basketball. And it's all him at 18, 19 years old. And it's, I mean, I got chills listening to it. It was like hearing him from beyond the grave. So once I had that, the idea of like building a story around Kobe and Jeremy, because Jeremy was so tight with him at the time, seemed like a cool way to do the pod. Instead of just straight up like bio of Kobe, let's tell this story through the lens of his friendship with Jeremy.
You wrote a story for the Philadelphia Inquirer about like Kobe and what he meant to like Lower Merion. You talked about how he was a part of the community and he was just as much Lower Merion as anybody else was. Many speak about Kobe like he was an outsider, you know what I mean? And he was like, you know, didn't quite understand, you know, the culture and when moving to Philly. Where does that narrative come from in comparison with the narrative you were talking with him being connected to the community?
Well, a couple different ways. Number one, he lived in Italy for 8 years, right? Because his dad was playing pro ball over there. So he would spend most of the year in Italy, then come home in the summertime, come back to the Philly area in the summertime, and then go back to Italy. So that's part of it. Another part of it is Philly's just freaking parochial, right? So he wasn't born in the city.
Yeah.
He was born just outside the city. So there are people who like hold that against him. Mm-hmm. That, you know, you're not really from Philly because you weren't born in Philly. You were born in Lower Merion. Mm-hmm.
I'm from Long Beach. I was just talking to a friend of mine last night who said, you know, I've lived in Long Beach since 1983, but I lived somewhere else for 20 years before that, and people never.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, it's like I very much
understand. Yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about here. And then the other thing was, he doesn't come back to the Philly area to live for good until he's in eighth grade, right? Mm-hmm. December of 1991, after living all that time in Italy. So he doesn't know the culture, right? He doesn't know what songs are cool. He doesn't know what fashion is cool. He doesn't know what TV shows to watch. He doesn't know what, like, Cheers and The Cosby Show and, you know, In Living Color and all. He doesn't have any frame of reference for any of that stuff. He doesn't quite fit in with the black kids yet. He doesn't, because he didn't grow up the way they did. He doesn't quite fit in with the WASPs and the Jewish kids who populate Lower Merion. So he's got to find his way. And basketball is the way he finds his way. And the way he does it is by kind of just melding into this community, right? If Kobe came along today, he'd be at IMG Academy or he'd be at Monteverde Academy like that. You know, some school that produces athletes and basketball players like a factory. He stayed and played for his local high school.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's, I kind of like that. That shows loyalty. That shows like he understood what it meant to play for this community. And no matter what else you say about him at any stage of his life, I like that aspect of him. So it is, it's kind of this weird juxtaposition of insider outsider, but I think that helps him like figure out how to move in all those worlds as he gets older.
Did he feel like an insider by the time he had left?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Okay. He knew, I mean, by the time he's a senior, right? Like he is driving his SUV to school and getting there before everybody else does. The principal, the faculty, students, everybody. He's parking in a prime parking spot and he is getting a janitor to open the school gym for him so he can shoot an hour before school every single day.
Mm-hmm.
And it used to tick people off because he'd take a prime parking spot at the school and he'd be like, you know what? I'm going to be better at basketball than the principal is at being a principal. Or at any of you,
I love you know, it.
Other, yeah, any of you other kids are going to, whatever jobs you're going to have, I'm going to be better at my job than yours, than you are going to be at yours. So I'm parking where I want to park. And that's just, and people came to accept it.
That is Kobe, if I ever heard Kobe. Yeah. So that brings me to this question that I would have here is, you know, when we first got introduced to Kobe, you know, 95, 96, the kid, you know, we saw him at the press conference in the suit and the sunglasses on top of his head, like a 17-year-old emulating like 30-year-old Michael Jordan, right? Like the kid would look spotlight ready from the very moment that Kobe kind of, you know, came into our consciousness. From your research and you know, talking with people and stuff, when did Kobe realize he was Kobe though? Like, did you dig into that a bit?
Yeah, summer of 1995, because that's the time where he's playing pickup ball and scrimmaging with NBA players and high-level Division I players. John Lucas, who was the Sixers coach at the time, his daughter was a classmate of Kobe's. And he sees Kobe play, and he wants to take Kobe with the number one pick in 96. He thinks he's that good right away. So he invites him to St. Joseph's University and to Episcopal Academy, this high school near Philly, to play pickup ball against Jerry Stackhouse and Sean Bradley and Rick Mahorn. And Kobe is going toe-to-toe with these guys. He is, if he's not the best player on the court all the time, he's good enough that he realizes, I don't need to go to college. Like, this is all the reaffirmation I need. I'm the best high school player in the country, and I'm jumping straight to the NBA. I can make this happen. And once he goes through that, he knows what's ahead for him. Like, the Lower Merion basketball team takes a trip to South Carolina, and he's getting autograph requests at the Yin Yang. And Jeremy Treatment's got him on tape saying, you know, hey, this is what I'm going to have to deal with. People expect autographs from me. That's what I'm going to have to do. I guess I just have to get used to it. Like, by the time he's early into his senior year, he knows exactly what is ahead for him, and he's preparing himself for that.
Quick question. You talk about him cooking. You know, I mean, I read about him cooking. Can you name some names? You mentioned Jerry Stackhouse. I mean, I know you said he was at least as good. Was he cooking, Jerry, as a junior? Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. We need names.
Sometimes he did. Okay. Sometimes he did. But the mythology of that summer has grown to where, like, Kobe dominated Jerry Stackhouse every time they played.
Okay.
And that did not happen.
Okay.
Like,
okay.
But keep in mind, like, Jerry Stackhouse was the number 3 pick in the draft. He was supposed to be the savior for the Sixers before they took Allen Iverson the next year. So, like, the idea that, like, this 17-year-old kid who's got one more year of high school is going toe-to-toe with him.
A bully, too. Jerry's one of the ones, you know what I mean?
Exactly. You know, and he's playing against Kerry Kittles, and he's dunking on Sean Bradley, and he's going around the bad boy Rick Mahorn for reverse layups. Like, he's a 17-year-old kid, so he's going to be graded on a curve in those moments.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Plus, he's working harder at those workouts than all the NBA players are. He's got his own strength coach who's with him there, running him and having him lift weights, and he's getting there early and staying late from all these workouts because there was no summer league at the time. It was all this pickup stuff on the Philly circuit. So everybody who was there that summer remembers how hard he worked and remembers seeing him holding his own or being better than these guys. He didn't have to be better than Stackhouse all the time, but enough to show that, like, holy crap, this kid is going to be really good.
Yeah.
You know, what I wanted to ask about was, you're a sports writer, I'm a sports writer. You know, if you have a kid playing at Lower Merion who's of Kobe's status now, he's got 15 million followers on Instagram. He goes live on IG anytime he wants to have a press conference that's more viewed than whatever ESPN is airing at that moment. He's probably been a known quantity since he was in 6th to 8th grade at the latest. Kobe was really one of the very last basketball superstars who did grow up in private to an extent. And you've got these artifacts of these interviews with him at that time, right? And as he was sort of being birthed into the public consciousness, but he was always so careful about his presentation in the media, right? I always felt like watching Kobe, if he wanted to remind people that his finger was hurting, he was doing something to make sure in the middle of a game that he's showing, you know, he knows the camera's over here. This one's on me right now. Did you feel like you got a sense of him truly before that persona, before that awareness was up? Like, did it feel like listening to a 16-year-old kid, or did it feel like someone who had kind of already put up a wall as far as this is how I'm going
to? No, there was a wall there. What's funny about to look back at that time, funniest about it most to me is that if you were in his inner circle, if you were in his family, if you were Jeremy Treatman, you knew he was going to the NBA. You knew it from the beginning of his senior year on. Nobody said anything. And all the coverage of that year, if you read, you know, my paper, the Philadelphia Inquirer, the Philadelphia Daily News, the national outlets, the national places that did interviews with him, it's nothing but mystery. Like, what is he going to do? What's going to happen here? He didn't tell anybody. Nobody told anybody. They were so far off. Like, I was an undergrad at LaSalle University at the time. Joe Bryant was the assistant coach at our basketball team. We were operating under the delusion that Kobe might actually come play at LaSalle because his dad was there. Now, he considered it. He thought about it when he was a sophomore and a junior because he loved his dad. He would want to go, maybe I want to go play for him. That went out the window that summer of 95. Like, once he's dunking on Stackhouse and Mahorn, it's like, the hell with LaSalle. I'm not going there. I don't need to go there.
Good decision.
Yeah, obviously. Good decision. Yeah. Pardon all my fellow LaSalle alumni, but yeah, good decision. But, you know, nobody knew that. So, you know, you see stories written all the time about how LaSalle is in the mix, and LaSalle wasn't in the mix at that point. So there was that. There was this sense of like watch the video of him making the announcement that he's going to take his talent to the NBA. He says, and I'm going to, and he pauses and he like puts his hand on his chin and he's clearly playing to the cameras. Clearly, like it is so cool, kind of like he's so self-assured. And he gets killed for that in the moment because media guys like me are mostly older and white and traditional, and they don't really process what they're seeing here. Like that this is a kid who knows he's in control of his future and he's going to chart this course for himself, and he doesn't like need to kowtow to anybody, you know, and he's that comfortable and self-assured that he can just be like, well, what am I going to do? Oh, just kidding. I'm going to take my talent to the NBA, you know, and he's just so confident in that moment. It's really revealing.
You talk about Kobe realizing who he is in, like, was it 95, 96?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, seeming like in the 90s, like, young talent was said to be the next Jordan. Like, every popular player was going to be the next Jordan, you know? The only players where it really seemed believable were, to me, Kobe and Bron, where, like, it mm-hmm. seemed like the commentators actually believed what they were saying. Mm-hmm. Like, you talk about the community. The people in the community know he was going to be as good as he was, or are they shocked, like, by how successful he ended up being?
His high school coach, Greg Downer, the guy who's still the head coach at Lower Merion, says to somebody Kobe's sophomore year, he turns to him in practice and says, does anybody realize we have the next Michael Jordan in our gym right now? He knows that, but not too many other people do. In fact,
that's a heady fucking thing.
At that time period, too. You know what I'm saying?
Exactly.
Yeah. Comparing exactly. him to a guy. You know what I mean?
Yeah. He was saying this right in the middle of MJ's three-peat, like 93, 94.
Right.
We've got the next one in our gym and nobody knows
it. He should have been wrong.
And it's understandable that they don't know it because Lower Merion went 4-20 Kobe's freshman year. Like, it should be impossible to do that, to lose 20 of 24 games with Kobe Bryant on your team.
Right.
But they did. So there's that, but like there's another teammate of his, kid who was the point guard, senior point guard when Kobe's a junior. He goes off to college and comes back the next year. And he visits practice and he sees Kobe. And he asks Kobe, so, you know, where are you going to school next year? Thinking that like Kobe's going to go to college, go play at Duke or wherever he's going to play, spend 2 years and have a nice career as like a sixth man in the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
And Kobe tells him, no, Evan, I'm going to the league next year. And Evan's like, no, seriously, like Duke, like North Carolina, like where are you going? And Kobe's like, no, I'm going to the league. And this kid, Evan Monsky, who's a really smart kid, close to Kobe, couldn't process it. Like he just could not.
Evan Monsky shouldn't though.
Right. Exactly.
You know what I mean?
Like, and most people were that way. Like most people knew he was great. They did not know he was going to be, you know, the next Jordan, one of the 10 best players of all time. Nobody could see it because in part, nobody could fathom that kid coming out of Lower Merion High School. Mm-hmm. It had no real basketball tradition to speak of before he got there.
Gotcha. One of the things that saddens me and I'm sure a lot of basketball fans about Kobe's passing is that, you know, especially for people our age who saw, you know, the entire trajectory of Kobe, you know what I mean? Like, we saw him go from the, you know, aloof, somewhat awkward, the standoffish kid who, you know, kept people at arm's length to, you know, when he passed, he was the, you know, the mentor who embraced the young talent. You know, he was a guy who, you know, was always, you know, we saw so many players talk about, you know, when I worked out with Kobe, you know, this summer or, you know, Kobe and I used to text all the time. And that was something that was just so tragic because, you know, we saw Kobe, you know, like I say, just develop into like this mentor, you know what I mean? So,
I think your point is right on. Like there was this feeling that there was more for him to do,
for sure,
that he was still growing and developing.
We had seen the best that Kobe had seen.
Yeah,
as a man, as a father, as a husband. Like, and I make this point in the book, like he traveled the perfect kind of like story arc for our society, right? Like he had been down by his own doing and he had come out of that. And that kind of is what separated him from Jordan, right? It's not that Jordan wasn't a better player. He was a better player. But Kobe traveled a different narrative arc than Jordan did. Michael never had to rehabilitate himself to the degree that Kobe did. And Kobe was still going on that journey. He was mentoring people. He was being a girl dad. He was, you know, bringing along women's basketball and being a mentor to all these women's basketball players and all of that. And, you know, wins an Academy Award and all of this stuff that he was branching out into. And everybody was kind of like, what else are we going to see from this guy? And it wasn't just that what he was doing now was great. It was that he had been this other guy and he had changed over time and our perception of him had changed over time. And I think that's what makes his story so fascinating to so many people.
Yeah. Well, obviously, everyone, please make sure you check the podcast out. And I'm looking forward to the book very much. But I think the number one thing, you know, people listening to the interview want to hear is just, is there another story or two or something from the podcast, you know, that'll really pique people's interest? Like the stuff you've mentioned already is incredible. But what's another hidden gem or two that, you know, people should go and look for in those
well,
episodes?
Well, I mean, we've got audio of Kobe talking about his senior prom with Brandy. You know, which is the equivalent was the equivalent in 1996 of like taking teenage Beyonce to your prom. I mean,
Brandy
it really was
huge back then, right? Huge.
Yeah, people forget that.
And he knew he was bigger
really
than Brandy,
was.
Which is really funny.
You know,
he thought he was the Brandy of that relationship.
He thought he was the Brandy at that prom. You know,
that's right.
Brandy got funny, to take him. You know what I'm saying?
And what's funny is that whole thing was a setup, right? Like she was dating Wanya Morris from Boys to Men at the time. Uh-huh. It was all kind of a publicity stunt to a great degree. So there's that. The one anecdote that is in the book that I really like, it's my personal favorite, is after Kobe ends up with the Lakers, he's talking to his agent at the time, Arne Tellem. And Tellem grew up in Philadelphia and in Lower Merion, so he knows all the Philly basketball history. And he's asking Kobe about like players he's going to encounter in the NBA. Like, what would you do against this guy? What are you going to do against that guy? And he asks him about John Stockton. Now, this is 1996. John Stockton is, you know, about to lead the Jazz with Karl Malone in two finals. He's the best point. He's dream team member, 10-time All-Star, all this stuff. Kobe's like, I played against guys like him in the Philly Catholic League all the time. I know what he's all about. Like, he took one of the three best point guards of all time and reduced him to a cultural stereotype like that.
To an Evan. He made him an Evan.
He's
Evan Motzke. Like,
and Tellem is like, Kobe, it's John Stockton. Like, this isn't some kid from Monsignor Bonner High School. You know, and Kobe's like, yeah, I know. I played against guys like him. So, again, that kind of tells you everything you need to know about him.
Yeah. One of one, man. You miss being.
That's right.
That's great. Okay, well, like I said, I Am Kobe. The first five episodes are out now from iHeartRadio. And the book, The Rise, Kobe Bryant and the Pursuit of Immortality, is coming out in January. Mike, hey, send us a couple copies of the book, man. We'll have you back on to talk about that in a couple
months.
I would
love it, guys. But thank you so much. This was great. Sure.
Thank you.
Appreciate
Mike.
You hopping
appreciate
on.
Absolutely.
You,
thanks for coming on. We appreciate it. All right, our thanks to Mike for hopping on with us for a truly unforgettable interview. I just felt like what an unbelievable position for that dude to be in to have anything at this point of someone as big as Kobe that had not already been consumed. That's why I was asking him about it. I was like, I must have felt like sitting on a national classified secret or something.
The tapes alone was like, whoa. Right. You know what I'm saying? Like discovering things like that. But yeah, it's hard to have conversations about people this popular that are interesting because, you know, everything's been talked about already. So, yeah. Good our, talk. Good interview.
Good interview. And thanks to Mike for hopping
good
on.
Good talk.
For real. And all right, that's all the time we got for Jenkins and Jones today. We'll be back in the middle of the week for another episode of Nonsense and Devilry. And we'll catch y'all then.
That's a devil.
That's a devil.
Bye.